Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
And a special opportunity today to test the waters on some of the issues that may be a part of the upcoming Understanding the Times tour with Dr. Camille Magdaly. This year, the theme of the tour is going to be A Tale of Four Cities, Washington, London, Canberra, and Jerusalem. It'll be the fifth year of the Understanding the Times tour, and it'll be coming to a city or town or a town that is near you on the beginning of August and going through to October. And I know that so many listeners all around Australia will be looking forward to another opportunity to hear Dr. Camille Magdaly teach on these issues that he's become renowned for. Dr. Camille Magdaly, of course, leads Teach All Nations and one of our regular guests on 2020. He's joining us for a bit of a preview of the tour and to unpack some insights into some of the latest issues, those global trends. We might be concerned about some things that are happening in the world. We might be excited about things that are happening in the world. Our opportunity today to talk about some of those and your opportunity to participate with a question or a comment either on our talkback line as we open it very shortly on 1-800-316-316 or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Vision Radio. But on the line from the UK, Dr. Camille Magdaly, a special welcome back to 2020.
Yes, good morning, Neil. Pleasure to be back.
It is good morning, and it's good morning for you too, I might add here, Camille, because thank you so much for staying up late, because as I understand, it's around about 1:30 in the morning where you are in the UK.
It is indeed.
But you're getting into some very nice weather, no doubt.
Yes, and long days where the sun sets at after 10 p.m.
Okay. Great. Camille, just before we get into some of the serious conversation, no doubt, that we'll have today, and I know that you're aware of the announcement of the passing of the significant Christian leader and writer of the amazing Word for Today, Bob Gass, who died in the US, and I know you've been a big fan of the Word for Today for a long time. I just wanted to get your impression as to how you were feeling when you got the news that Camille, that Bob had passed away.
Well, it was a big surprise. Of course, he's been a part of my life through the Word for Today for the last decade, exactly 2009, through Vision, of course. And it's a daily diet of Bob Gass, or actually of the Word for Today through Bob Gass, that has been a mainstay for myself. And as I've often shared with Vision listeners on tour, that I'm a Bible teacher, and I'm finding great value out of the Word for Today. And so if I can, so can you. And, of course, many do. And I was amazed how many had already been subscribing to the Word for Today when they came. And, in fact, that's how they ended up at our meetings. But it has been a pleasure to read this man's writings, very practical, solidly biblical, Jesus at the center of it all.
Interesting, our terminology when someone who is a renowned Christian believer dies. Sometimes we're afraid of using that word, that person has died or that person is dead. We like to soften things by saying that person has passed away. There is something significant, Camille, about what happens when a believer dies, when a believer is, and you know, this sort of terminology that we adopt in our Christian walk, promoted to glory. There is something very powerful about what happens when we celebrate the life of someone who is such a renowned Christian leader, a renowned Christian believer. This is, for many, obviously I always refer to these things as a sad time. But we encourage ourselves that this is not such a time of sadness as it is in giving glory to God, because there has been a promotion to glory. What are your thoughts on the way we treat the idea of dying when we're Christian believers?
Well, I do have to deal with this topic a bit, even though I don't perform funerals, but I do teach on last days. And that's part of the issue with last days, is what happens to people when they die. And Scripture is clear that for believers, we do not mourn as those that do not have hope, because we know that when you're absent from the body, you are present with the Lord. That is a very, very clear situation. And I still remember the thoughts or words of at least one or more famous evangelists, where they said, one day you're going to read in the newspaper that the evangelist is dead. Don't you believe it. I will be more alive then than I am right now. And I'm pretty sure that would be the attitude of Bob Geff.
Yes, and there's no doubt lots more to talk about so far as Bob Geff, and there'll be more tributes that will come through the day, no doubt. And I'll point listeners to a post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/visionradio, where you can see some of the significant posts that are responses to those listeners and those who have been readers of the Word for Today who've been posting their comments there. And I'd invite listeners, if you're a real Bob Geff fan, and so many are, 150,000 distribution quarterly here in Australia. So there's an awful lot of people who have been loving the ministry of Bob Geff and the things that he's written now over so many decades. You might have your own thoughts, and you might like to post your own thoughts on that Facebook post and read the sorts of things that others have been saying about their experience of the Word for Today and their honour to God for a great man like Bob Geff. Camille, let's move on into some of the sorts of things that we had scheduled to talk about today in our conversation. Of course, the preparations for the Understanding the Times tour in Australia, getting ready for August, and what are your preparations like at this point? Are you all on schedule to make these things happen?
Well, yes, we are. We've had a slight change of arrangements with Vision on that. I won't go into the details, but Vision continues to partner with our ministry, Teach All Nations, and it's a wonderful, wonderful partnership. But we have pretty much managed to fill the schedule. It's as many meetings this year, if not more, than we had last year. And last year was over 50 meetings over a 10-week period. So it's been the preparation has been great. Working with Ben Fairley at Vision, and he's enthusiastic and very punctual in his responses, at least up till now. That doesn't change. But it's been it's been fine. We are still finalizing some details, but the promotional push is, of course, very closely down the road. So we look forward to that as well.
You've got a theme this year, and in some sense it's a general theme, and you'll no doubt be honing and bringing these issues into a pointed focus for the sort of message that you'll be bringing to Australians when you get the Understanding the Times tour underway. You've got a title called A Tale of Four Cities, London, Washington, Canberra and Jerusalem. This is the overall theme, and there's something that these cities have in common. There are obviously going to be different dimensions that you'll bring out, but it is an interesting title. What is this this concept and connections with the idea of A Tale of Four Cities?
Well, thanks for that question, Neil. I will do my best to answer it. I'm still piecing together what it all means, but these cities are not just a tale, they are actually instruments of shaking that's happening in our world. As you recall, there has just been a state visit to the United Kingdom by President Trump, and there you have both London and Washington. One of the interesting things, Mr. Trump went home very much on cloud nine. He got the royal treatment, literally. And the thing that they were saying, many things that are being said, of course, but one of them is that the alliance between the United States and the United Kingdom is perhaps the most special and unique and most powerful, not just in modern times, but in history. That may be true, but what else is true is the influence, without having an alliance, of these two countries on the world has been massive. But having said that, there's also what we have in Canberra and Australia's contribution. which may not seem like a big contribution when it comes to the world stage, but no, there is a contribution for sure. And then, of course, Jerusalem is the city of the Bible and continues, even till now, to have biblical and prophetic implications.
Okay, let's talk about the Trump visit to the UK. You've opened up all sorts of great possibilities where we can enlarge our conversation. Interestingly, as you say, it was a cloud nine feeling that Trump would have been feeling going away, because it really was a state visit. The pomp and ceremony that was there, and honouring the relationship between the US and the UK. I can't help but thinking, and some of the reports that I've seen or read about the visit of Donald Trump to the UK, that those who are anti-Trump really a lot of sour grapes. But around the occasion, of course, 75 years after the D-Day events ending World War II, when you're actually a critic of either of leaders of either nation in that time, you really don't look all that good. Those sour grapes can't look so good for the opponents of Donald Trump. What are your thoughts for the reporting on what happened around the visit?
Okay, well, I guess it depends where you are. The BBC tried to be objective enough, and yeah, there was sour grapes. It was coming from the mayor of London. It was coming from the opposition leader, and especially they represented it. But what it really seemed to be, they did have protests. As far as I know, the protests, which they were promising to be the biggest in history, fell far, far short of that. It really seemed to be a left-wing rant. And the irony of it all is, of course, Mr. Trump represents the country that was so instrumental in helping turn the fortunes of the Second World War. I mean, that's the United States. The British were pretty much on their own in fighting the Nazis, and then the Americans come. And, of course, what was interesting is 75 years ago, June 1944, their country was flooded with American troops because of D-Day. D-Day is the reason we can all, up till now, speak freely, no matter what our ideology may be like. And so it seemed pretty ironic to be denouncing a man who's representing a country that has been symbolic, not just symbolic, but embodying human freedoms and human rights. I mean, at least because of D-Day, they could have their left rant and face no consequences for it. But as I've been teaching both on UTT and also on Faith in the Future, we're in a culture war. And this culture war isn't getting any better, it's getting worse. And that's part of the manifestation of it. As I'd like to remind people, Mr. Trump did not cause the culture war, but he is like a stick being poked into the hornet's nest of that war.
Helping you make sense of life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
Great to have you with us. Talkback line open, 1-800-316-316. Talking through issues, global trends, being future ready, and a little bit of a preview to the Understanding the Times tour with Dr. Camille Majdali that will get underway in August this year. This year he has a theme, A Tale of Four Cities, London, Washington, Canberra, and Jerusalem. And in the Camille Majdali style, we'll bring out some incredible insights about those four centres and other global trends during the Understanding the Times tour. So 1-800-316-316 to join in our conversation. Leave a comment on our Facebook page. Camille, as we talk about what has just happened with the commemorations for D-Day, the visit to the UK of Donald Trump, and of course the issues all around friendships between those two nations, the US and the UK, can't help but think that when you've got those four nations that you'll be talking about, in some sense here, the friendships between these nations have been forged in the heat of battle. which was something that certainly was brought out with the commemorations for D-Day. What are your thoughts for the way friendships are often forged?
Well, you actually know who your friends are when you're in trouble, don't you? It's not in the good times. It's in the bad times. The friends stick together, and the fair weather friends just fade away. So yes, absolutely, whether it's Gallipoli or whether it's D-Day, it's important. Can I just remind our listeners why D-Day was so important? Is we don't seem to think of it now, but Europe was in the grips of fascism. I mean, real fascism, not the pseudo-fascism we're hearing so often. And it was serious business. I mean, absolutely, the Nazis had taken over just about all over the continent, and D-Day was the beginning of the end of the Third Reich. It was the biggest invasion, land, air, and sea, in history. 150,000 troops landing on the shores of Normandy on that fateful day, June 6, 1944. It was, as I said, the beginning of the end of the Third Reich. It took another 10 months before Germany surrendered, but this is what turned the fortunes of the whole war. So the Allies were attacking from the west, and of course the Soviet Union was attacking from the east, and the Nazis were caught in the middle. It was a wonderful, wonderful victory, but boy, it came at a high price. And from that, the Americans, the British, and of course the Australians played a very important part.
Camille, Donald Trump is quoted as saying the veterans not only had vanquished Nazi tyranny, he said, but it built the American century. Now, of course, he's being very national pride filled there in talking about the American century. But of course, when we talk about the American, the 20th century, of course, we are talking about a century which was very dominated by American culture and the influence around the world. This idea of actually winning with allies together and changing the course of history, because we could speculate, couldn't we, as to what might have happened had the Third Reich in fact prevailed, and there could have been huge differences to the way that we relate to one another. But what are your thoughts for the idea that there are ideological positions, and you say fascism was defeated, but if there were different outcomes to that, things would be very different today. It sends a strong message to the way that we need to be looking to get things right in the way that we support various ideological positions. What are your thoughts for that?
Oh, I don't even know where to begin with this question. There's so much that is happening. But first, it is important, Neil, that we define our terms. Today we hear the word fascist thrown around basically against anyone that is against a progressive agenda. Now, that is ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. I'm not even sure the person using the word knows what they're talking about. Oftentimes the answer is no, they don't. Fascism is, first of all, not just a totalitarian system that tramples on human rights and the rest, it also is against any notion of the transcendent, meaning they don't believe in God. They are godless, sinful, atheistic rulers. And I'm telling you, they're very, very bad. It's been often said, and wrongly in my opinion, that religion has caused all the wars. And that, of course, is usually a secular humanist argument. But actually, it's the wars that were in the 20th century, two world wars to be exact, plus a Cold War, plus what happened in China, have taken far, far more lives than those that had a religious basis. See, in our Western system, there is an acknowledgement, even if it's not done a lot, that there's a God in heaven that is keeping us accountable. Why do we still, amazingly, have prayers in the Australian Parliament when it opens? And why is there in the Australian Constitution a preamble that says humbly relying on the blessings of Almighty God? See, the system we have, the democratic system, is there is some acknowledgement there's a higher power than even our own governments. Whereas in a fascist system, there's absolutely no acknowledgement whatsoever of God. It's basically, we're the boss.
And this is interesting, Camille, because some of the ideologies that drive some of our political parties, and without naming them, but I know listeners will get an idea when we talk about this, those that have a godlessness at their heart, this is a growing trend. And it's not just a trend in Australia, it's a trend in the UK, it's a trend in the US. What are your thoughts for that trend?
Well, it's a very disturbing trend, and from people who know what they're talking about, and I respect because I do read a lot of commentary, that is, people who don't have a fear of God will end up being totalitarian, dictatorial, abusive. I'm talking about in government. And those that do have a fear of God or acknowledgement of God will tend to be, of course, those that treat human rights as something that is to be honored, and that the individual is important, and that government is not there to be served, but to serve its people. Vast difference of worldviews, and it has to do whether you believe in God.
We're taking calls on 1-800-316-316. Let's take a call from Marion in Albany in Western Australia. Hello, Marion. Welcome along.
Good morning to you both, and thank you, Camille, for being up at this very early hour in the UK. We arrived as migrants in this country in Fremantle in Western Australia on D-Day, the 6th of June, 1952. So it's quite significant, and I think people our age, I was 5 years old when we came to Australia, appreciate the significance of D-Day. I've been privileged to go to Normandy, to the Normandy beaches where they landed, and seeing the memorials to these wonderful young men who gave their lives for us and our freedom, to see those countless myriads of white crosses, it really hit home about the significance of that achievement. So I think we should be very thankful, and also with our own election and Trump's election in, we can see God's hand, that God prevailed in this, and we can thank him for it and for the freedom that we enjoy today.
Good thoughts, Marion. What are your responses there, Camille?
Well, thank you, Marion, for your comments and your call. I think it's always a wise thing to do to look back and reflect from where we've came, because as one that deals with the future, it's amazing. I feel because of my history background, I'm well positioned for the future, because we have to both look backward before we can even look forward to remind ourselves how did we get to where we are, and both positively and negatively. But yes, D-Day and the successful fight against Euro-fascism and Japanese, or shall we say East Asian fascism. I mean, it was on two fronts. Let's not forget, especially for the Americans. They're fighting two oceans, basically. But when we see the price that was paid, and it was a horrifically high price, it should make us humble and grateful for what we have, and it should also make us aware of that it shouldn't happen again. But one of the things I was going to say, it didn't come out yet, is that from voices I respect, that some of the ideology, the fascist ideology that was defeated in the two world wars, unfortunately is being taught in some of our institutions of higher education even now. And I'm not talking about just in Australia. I'm talking about across the Western world. So have we learned any lessons from history? Unfortunately, in many cases, the answer is no. But hopefully enough people remember and will pray it through so that the answer truly will be yes.
Camille, let's get a little bit of a focus on what's been happening in the UK. We're on the phone to you in the UK. It's around about 2 a.m. in the morning. Thank you for staying up late for us. But let's talk about the developments around Brexit. And, of course, the new potential Prime Minister that will be chosen sometime soon, because Theresa May has resigned. And, of course, there's a process now going on before a new Prime Minister is going to be appointed. But what are your thoughts overall for how the Brexit is continuing on 3 years after the people decided that they wanted to leave the European Union?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I feel like I'm in the middle of it all,
yes.
Since I'm not that far from London. But first of all, let me remind our listeners what Brexit is about. It's a grand divorce of the United Kingdom from the European Union, of which it has been a part for the last 46 years. And Australians probably, unless they travel and the like and have been in the EU, may not understand, but this is a big deal. In fact, it has been rightly called the biggest issue Britain has faced since the Second World War, which I'm telling you, that's big. And yes, after 3 years, Britain is still in the European Union. They had a 29th of March deadline to leave, and Mrs. May promised probably 100 times, literally over 100 times, that Britain would leave no matter what on the 29th of March. But as you can see, Britain did not. I won't go into all the details why that happened, but now the deadline is the 31st of October. And Mrs. May's had too many defeats, council elections and European Parliament elections. The fact that Britain was voting for the European Parliament just recently was so, what can you say, outlandish, because they're voting for an election in a body they're trying to get out of. And in fact, there was a political cartoon. The year was 3,300, and the space aliens were looking down on planet Earth, and the thing they said, yes, and Britain is still trying to leave the European Union, you know, in 3,300, you know, AD kind of thing. So because of the failure to leave, Mrs. May has stepped down as leader of the Tory party. In fact, that it's effective today. She's no longer the Tory leader, but the prime minister will be chosen not right at this moment, but apparently sometime next month will be chosen to take over. And I've been reading the comments of the contenders, and they're all promising, I will deliver Brexit no matter what by the 31st of October. So they're making pretty much the same promise to keep the deadline as Theresa May has done. There are complications. It's, as I said, it's a big deal. And part of it is getting Brussels to agree to an agreement or getting the British Parliament to agree to the Brussels agreement. But there is another thing, and that is leave without any agreement whatsoever. And personally, I think that the no deal is not as apocalyptic as they're all trying to make it sound. Obviously, it'll be disruptive, but hey, it's a divorce. What do you expect? This is what's going to happen.
Camille, when we think of the European Parliament making it so hard for the British to leave the European Union, from what I understand, and you might have some more detail around this, but they're desperate to keep the relationship intact because a little bit like when one domino falls, others are in fact lining up to have their own exit from the EU, and that could actually spell some level of disaster for the security of Europe. What are your thoughts for why there is such an intense pressure to keep Britain a part of the European Union?
Well, I mean, Britain has several key roles. One, it is one of the major powers of Europe. Of course, France and Germany are the other, so it really is up there in the top three of the 28-nation member EU. I might just add, it's not the European Parliament that's doing this issue. It is actually the European Commission,
right. And
it's 28-member unelected commission. They are the ones that make the laws. They're the ones that decide. The Parliament, for lack of a better term, just rubber stamps whatever the Commission wants. It's not Parliament as we understand Parliament. They actually make the laws and the Governor General signs. So why do they want to keep it? Britain is a top nation. Britain is a top contributor. Now, technically, Britain has received benefit, too, out of the Union. But one of the things is Britain is an island nation, and their fisheries, they're being told by the EU how much of their fish they can catch. I think it reduced their fishing industry by 80% down to 20%. I mean, can you imagine British fisheries closing down because the EU wants to send other countries to encroach on British coastal waters. I mean, that in itself was an indignity that had gone on for many years. So, but they also don't want to set an example. If Britain leaves successfully, that might encourage others to do likewise. But they don't want to punish Britain too much either, because there is an interdependency. Britain is part of Europe without any EU, and yet Britain is a part as well, as its history has clearly shown. So it doesn't, it's a catch-22. They don't want to make it easy for Britain, lest others get ideas of exiting too. But they don't want to make it too hard, because if Britain suffers, they will be suffering a bit as well.
While we're talking global trends, Camille, the future of Europe, which looks uncertain, and if Brexit goes ahead and deal or no deal, and there are others who are contemplating the possible exit from the European Union, what are your thoughts? Because I know that of recent times you've written all sorts of things about the growing secularisation in Europe, the way that they've left behind many of those Christian foundations that are a part of so many of those European nations. What are your thoughts for the future of Europe because of these big ructions that are happening, like Brexit?
Well, as I've been saying for a while, and that's part of the reason I'm here out of Australia, is because Europe is in a spiritual winter. This is the continent that gave us Western civilization with many, many positives, especially Protestant Christianity. It is enormous and sent missionaries all over the world. But now, during its spiritual slumber, many bad things have been happening, and we need to help Europe be restored back to its Judeo-Christian roots, not the least of which Europe is on the front lines of the great civilizational culture war, something I've been talking about in the Understanding the Times tour for the last 2 years, and of course it will come up again this year as well. I do it pastorally, of course. I'm mad at nobody. We love everybody kind of thing, but the fact is the culture war, we experience it in Australia to a some big extent, and we sort of had it in the last federal election campaign. But I'm telling you, in Europe, it's big. So without a revival, because revival is the only solution to this culture war, we're in trouble. I might add, there's another plank to winning the culture war, and that's by strengthening families. Absolutely strengthening families is like having a revival as well. So those are two very positive things we can do. But Europe, in the meantime, needs help, and that's why there's been missionaries coming from all over the world from the mission field to help the mother continent get back on her spiritual feet.
Well, winning a culture war is a big challenge, and how you strengthen families, that's another big challenge, and I suspect there's no easy answers to that. But certainly the influence of the way a culture continues to evolve is going to be an important part of that. And somehow or other, Camille, whether it's prayer input or whether it's those sorts of mission endeavours into Europe, those are going to perhaps play a key role in how the churches are encouraged in Europe. What are your thoughts for, you know, the rest of the world as we look on, and here we are down under, looking at those things that are going on in Europe, wondering how we respond, because, you know, Europe is big and it's got the history, and here we are in Australia not necessarily feeling like, you know, we're going to be a huge influence there, but what can the rest of the world do to help the European context, do you think?
Oh, well, it's like with everything else, Neil, we first of all need to be informed. For too long, we've lived within our four walls. We've been parochial and narrow-minded. I'm talking in general. I'm not talking about just Australia. It's just human nature. And we need to get out of our box, especially because our Savior told us to go into all the world. I cannot imagine any other plan that he has but this one. Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. So we have to be outward looking, and it's wrong to merely be inward looking, because that's the great trend in our world today, me, myself, and I, being very much enclosed in our own things. Prayer is also incredibly vital. And I think wherever and whatever the Holy Spirit tells us to do, we need to do, in addition to our prayers, in addition to being informed, in addition to having, as I often say, the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. But I have to say, Australia has it really good. I didn't ever think I would say that because I'm well aware of some of the challenges. But frankly, I feel like kissing the tarmac at Melbourne Airport when I come, when I realize some of the wonderful things we have. Just, I mean, for example, Christian schools, we at least have opportunity to send our children to private, affordable Christian schools. They don't have that kind of luxury where I'm at. Certainly not in the UK, and I would dare say least of all in Europe itself. So we need to be informed, we need to pray, and we need to obey whatever God tells us to do so we can make a difference in this world.
Let's reflect for a few moments here, Camille, on remaining with Europe for a few moments, because in Europe, big challenges, but some significant things have happened. I mean, the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral, it almost brought this sort of sense of the fact that churches in Europe are like a relic of Christianity. There's something there, but it did spark a global outpouring of grief when that cathedral burned. And I wonder whether, because we're talking about Europe and the fact that this was the home of such a Christian foundation, saw the rise of Protestantism, as you say. What were your thoughts for the way that things are changing in Europe so dramatically away from God, and yet there was this outpouring of grief when such a significant building was burned with fire? What are your thoughts for the spirituality of Europe in that sense?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, Neil. One of the things that I have pointed out, and listeners will know who have come to Understanding the Times, is that the European Union, movers and shakers I'm talking about, have been secular humanists that have been in denial that Christianity had anything to do with European identity, which is absolutely ludicrous when you consider the Christian fingerprints and footprints all over the continent. And Notre Dame is one of those symbols. It is a Christian symbol. Although, let's remember, during the French Revolution, they took Mother Mary out of the picture, and they crowned reason as Queen of France, which was, of course, part of the Enlightenment. But what was so amazing, this is what gets me, the same people who want to deny that Christ and Christianity have anything to do with European history and identity were mourning for Notre Dame and giving money. So in a sense, there's both a great irony here, but a great hope. In one sense, the burning was a bad omen, you know, Christianity in trouble in Europe. But the fact so many people worldwide cared, and I think they raised over $1 billion to rebuild Notre Dame, that in a sense is symbolically a great hope as well. And of course, Jesus said clearly, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Attempts throughout church history again and again to destroy the church, they've all failed. It'll fail again. But the question is, at what price? And it's up to the church today to make sure that price is very, very small.
From what I understand, Camille, there had actually been even hundreds of attacks against churches in France before the Notre Dame burning. And not to say that that was an attack, because I don't know whether that's all fully known about Notre Dame, but it seems to be that when these lesser churches are suffering, whether it's an attack or whether it's just that they're struggling to even remain viable, but when the fire comes to Notre Dame, a very, very significant icon of Christianity in Europe, then people all of a sudden realize that maybe something's wrong here. Is this something that you might be able to reflect on as a trend that happens in secularized societies?
Well, I believe the fire of Notre Dame is a wake-up call, and not that everyone sees it as a wake-up call for the right reasons, but it when something like Notre Dame gets on fire, and yes, it it conjures up a lot of imagery, and you rightly use the word iconic. It is iconic. Yes, it is a wake-up call. It is a fact that there is something seriously wrong happening. Again, you're right. We don't know officially what the cause was, and it could very well have been accidental. We don't know. But what we do know is that it really touched a chord for people well beyond France. I mean, let's also remember, France is the country that attracts more tourists than any other country on earth. They don't even have to promote tourism. People just come. And so Notre Dame, being an international icon, not just a French one, will strike home. So it is a time to realize that, hey, things are not as they should be, and it's up to us to take the appropriate action. And as Christians, we need to follow the injunction of Jesus himself. He says we need to watch and we need to pray. That's part of successful and victorious last days living. Watch and pray.
You'll be getting ready to come to Australia again very soon, Camille, the Understanding the Times tour. And I know as listeners are hearing us reflect on things that are happening in Europe and the UK, and also the relationship, as we've been talking about a little earlier on, with the D-Day commemorations and where the US fits in all of that. We haven't had much time today to even get into talking about Jerusalem. I know you love to talk about Israel and Jerusalem, and we've only got a few minutes really remaining in our conversation, but I wanted to just touch on, while we're reflecting on these global trends and things that are happening in Europe, the US, you're coming to Australia, and sometimes we can feel a little bit isolated from things that are happening, but I wonder how you might be connecting Australians into what's happening globally, so that we're aware of the fact that there are things that happen on a huge international scale that affect us here in Australia. What are your thoughts for the sorts of things you might bring to Australian audiences when you're talking to them a little later this year?
Well, I'm going to bring, of course, the fact that there's a shaking going on in our world, and London and Washington in particular have been in the front lines. Of course, London with Brexit and Washington with Trump, and both Brexit and Trump, of course, were features of 2016 and of elections therein. And the turbulence we're seeing now, 3 years later, is directly related to the British referendum on Brexit, as well as the election of Donald Trump. I don't think people realize that what is happening with this president is without precedent. The opposition he's faced from the moment his victory was announced until now is amazing. Now, there have been polarizing figures in U.S. history of late, but nothing like this. And it's easy to blame him because, of course, he's getting all this attention. But no, there's something spiritual going on, which I'll hopefully explain. The same with Brexit. Brexit ultimately is a spiritual issue, and it's amazing the amount of prayer that has gone up for Brexit by people in Britain who are Christian. It's amazing. I was in a prayer meeting of 3,000 people, very spirit-filled prayer meeting at Wembley, and we were praying for Brexit because they see it as a spiritual thing. And as far as what's happening in Israel, just remember, every Israeli election is a hung parliament. It's a big deal in Australia to have a hung parliament. I think we had it in 2010. But every election is a hung parliament. Now, for the first time in 70 years of history, the hung parliament is really hung. They couldn't form a coalition with Netanyahu, so they have to go to the polls again in September. I mean, that is astounding. That has never happened. So there's things going on there, too. And, of course, Mr. Netanyahu is being hounded by the Attorney General that he's corrupt and he's going to go to trial even as Prime Minister. And I mean, it's unbelievable stuff. You think at his age he might want to wind it down, but Mr. Netanyahu is ratcheting it up for sure as we continue on wondering what is going to happen in Israel and who actually is going to be in charge.
Well, we are running out of time. To mention that the theme of your tour that's coming up starting in August is A Tale of Four Cities, Washington, London, Canberra, and Jerusalem. And as we're talking about global trends, I know listeners will have had their appetite whet because the sorts of commentary we hear in the mainstream media and the sorts of reports we might read in the newspapers, you bring a tremendous dimension, Camille Majdali, and honour to you for that. It's going to be the fifth time that you've done these tours, and there are people I know who honour you tremendously because not only do you go to the capital cities, but you find your way oftentimes into regional towns and sometimes even outback communities. And I know people really appreciate having someone who has the respect that you command so far as your writings and for the tours that you lead and the programming that you have here on Vision Radio. They love to have the opportunity to have someone of your caliber come to their community. I'm sure there may be a space or two left, although I think you said this is already getting bigger and bigger every year, and I'm not sure if you can squeeze in any more dates, but I'll point listeners to Teach All Nations website. So tan.org.au, and I know that there'll be some details there, and you might like to preview the dates, you might like to access some of the resources that Camille has on offer. tan.org.au, that's Teach All Nations, and I'm not sure whether the post is up yet, but of course you'll be able to get those details a little closer to the tour as those things become firm on the Vision website at vision.org.au. Dr. Camille Majdali, thanks so much for staying up late. Appreciate you, and look forward to seeing you on your arrival back in Australia, and we'll expect good things. The Lord's blessing on you and your wonderful wife.
Thank you, Neil. God bless Australia.
Before you go, thanks for listening.
There's lots more great audio on demand, or you can listen to us live at visionradio.org.au.
And remember, Vision is listener supported. Your donation,
large or small,
will help us continue connecting faith to life for hundreds of thousands of people across Australia and around the world.
Learn more or donate today at visionradio.org.au.